With the election now behind them, our friends Laurel, John, and Sean are taking some well-earned time off. They're on a walk in the country. The air is crisp. The scenery is breathtaking.
Wow, this scenery is breathtaking.
And the air sure is, I don't know, crisp.
Gosh, this is just so great. Great, 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 great.
Guys, did you hear that?
Oh no.
It's a news avalanche!
Ah! Ah! It's a presidential recount!
And new COVID-19 executive orders!
And posturing between the governor and legislative leaders!
And lawsuits! So many lawsuits!
Guys, I think we're trapped.
We're surrounded by news.
Well, while we wait for somebody to come dig us out, should we do the podcast?
Heck yeah, we should!
I guess. Why not?
Well, this is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm John K. Wilson.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week, let's talk about a Wisconsin news avalanche.
And I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above?
And that number, of course, is Landslide by Stevie Nicks, performed by Fleetwood Mac from their 1975 album of the same name, Fleetwood Mac, which is actually the second album they released called Fleetwood Mac, the first being their 1968 debut. And I know that Rumors gets all of the attention in terms of their discography, but, you know, I feel like this one also just has some gems on it, Landslide being one of them, which you can use in any sort of avalanche or landslide-themed scenario that you might need it.
How you doing, John? I know that Fleetwood Mac gets you kind of misty. You okay?
Yeah. No, I'm doing all right.
All right. Good.
I was crying a little bit earlier, but we're good.
You're going to be able to pull through and talk about stuff?
Yeah. Good thing I brought my little record player with me here while on our nature hike, and it survived our avalanche, and it's in our little snow cave playing some records.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hardy little thing.
We thought it was a lot to pack when we left, but I'm glad we have it now.
Who needs an avalanche beacon when you have a record player and Fleetwood Mac's entire discography on vinyl?
They will find us by following Stevie's voice.
So I guess we have a few things to talk about this week. Sort of, we have recount stuff and we have COVID politics stuff. Do we want to start with recount stuff?
I think we should. Yeah. It's, you know, the Western civilization hangs in the balance depending on the outcome of our election, or maybe not, but I don't know. It's pretty important.
Not to put too much pressure on it or anything.
No pressure at all.
Yeah. So a presidential election recount started today in Wisconsin, in two counties. But before we sort of get into the specifics of that, do we want to maybe just walk through a little background information about Trump filing the recount or the election results, the canvassing, all the stuff that led us to today, where ballots started being retallied?
It's not really background information. It happened like 2 days ago, which is the funny thing. There's such a news avalanche this week that was Wednesday, maybe?
Wednesday, yes. Wednesday morning was when the Trump campaign filed its official request.
Yep. So, yeah. Okay. I'll start with the easy part. Like, we were thinking there might be a recount because the margin, according to unofficial numbers, was less than one percentage point between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And then once the official canvass was completed, the margin was basically the same. And so that gave Donald Trump the option of requesting a recount. And so what we found out this week was if he had requested a statewide recount, that would have cost $7.9 million. So he didn't do that. He requested a recount in Dane and Milwaukee counties. You might have heard, since you are listening to a politics podcast, that these counties elect Democrats. And so that is obviously a part of the Trump campaign's decision, is to go after the largest chunks of Democratic votes as part of this recount.
And what did the Trump campaign say in terms of their reasoning for targeting these two counties? I mean, you can look at the political reasoning behind it, sort of, or the implications there, you know, that these are very Democratic-leaning areas. But what did the campaign say in terms of why they wanted to focus on these counties?
So in their presidential, in the recount request, they said that they believed that there was illegal altering of absentee ballots, illegal issuing of absentee ballots, and illegal advice from government officials to voters related to Wisconsin's voter ID law, and that those things happened all across the state of Wisconsin, but they happened particularly in Dane and Milwaukee counties. And so that's why they wanted to focus on those two counties in their recount.
And I guess it bears saying right off the bat that Wisconsin election officials say they don't have any evidence of, you know, widespread fraud or irregularities or anything in those two specific counties or in any counties across the state. That's just what the Trump campaign is alleging, you know, sort of which tracks with what they've been doing in terms of lawsuits and other things in multiple states across the country, sort of pointing to supposed fraud or irregularities, which they haven't really been able to provide evidence for.
Right. So, you know, for weeks, it's been weeks now, right? Today is the 20th. Yeah, weeks since Election Day, election officials in Wisconsin have said that there hasn't been any evidence of fraud or irregularities in the election. And the Trump campaign has specifics when it talks about illegally altered ballots or illegally issued ballots. And in those specific scenarios that they bring up, election officials say these are policies that have been in place for several elections, for years. The number that they use for one of the policies in particular is the last 11 elections. This policy has been in place, and no one, including the Trump campaign for the 2016 presidential recount, has pushed back on them before or raised any issues with them before. So these aren't things that are, fraudulent behavior or irregularities that are that surprising to us, I guess, as we're moving into this recount, because the Trump campaign had kind of signaled that they were things that they believed to be illegal already. And so clerks have had the opportunity to respond to these things in particular and to have a pretty clear position that's very different from the Trump campaign's position about whether things were conducted the way that they should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you take kind of a big picture look at this recount, this is not like a Florida year 2000 recount where it's going to come down to, like, do you count a hanging chad or not? It's not that kind of recount. They are challenging the system. I mean, they are challenging the guidance to clerks by the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which has stood for 4 years now and has never before been challenged. And I mean, if you take it sort of to its logical end, some of the stuff they're challenging would disqualify all absentee ballots that were requested through the myvote.wi.gov website, which is what the state was encouraging people to use. So it's very broad in one sense, in that it would go after tens of thousands of voters in different categories. At the same time, it's very focused on two counties, ignoring the other 70, on two counties that elected Democrats at higher margins than anyone else.
Right. I mean, the election was close, you know, out of all votes cast, but 20,000 plus votes is still a lot to, you know, have mistakenly been counted, you know, so it's not like we recount all the votes and all of a sudden, oh, like we miscounted 20,000 votes, Trump actually got more votes. The idea here is more to raise challenges to large chunks of votes in counties that went heavily for Joe Biden.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we should go through some of these categories a little bit more. So, like, I just alluded to one of the challenges in that the Trump campaign is bringing involves whether or not people had a written application for their absentee ballots. And so if you like take that a certain direction and say, well, is an electronic request written, that opens up a potential challenge to those requests. Laurel, what are some others where we're talking about large groups of voters?
So the other big one, aside from absentee ballots requested on myvote.wy.gov, which you're right, I mean, that was a huge source of absentee ballots for people this year and what the state pointed people to, the Trump campaign is also challenging every ballot cast at an early voting site in the 2 weeks before Election Day, because there aren't any paper applications given out for absentee ballots at early voting sites. Voters don't have to fill one out. It has been policy for several years for election officials to be able to just give them the absentee ballot envelope and the information on that absentee ballot envelope under policy constitutes the application. So it would be throwing out a huge number of early votes from in-person early voting. We know that in-person early voting was absolutely huge this year. It crushed records in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And again, this is in two counties, which, I mean, they have the legal right to focus their request on specific counties. That is their right. But in-person absentee voting happened elsewhere, you know, in Republican counties. And they're not challenging that specific provision in those counties.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that when I was at the Dane County headquarters today, Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald pushed on back on that and said that he didn't think that it was proper that, you know, essentially the Trump campaign is singling out two counties for policies that were implemented statewide for this election and trying to throw out votes in two counties in particular for these policies. Another big chunk of ballots that could be thrown out under the Trump campaign's push, I guess I'll call it, are all of the ballots cast by indefinitely confined voters in Wisconsin. We've talked about indefinitely confined voters before. Basically, these are folks that just check a box on their absentee ballot application and say that they're not able to leave their home. And when they do that, they don't have to provide a copy of their photo ID, of their voter ID. And this is something that Republicans have had a problem with in Wisconsin. They say that it allows people to skirt the state's voter ID law. And so they think that people were taking advantage of that, checking that they were indefinitely confined when they're not, in fact, indefinitely confined. And so their solution to that is to throw out all indefinitely confined ballots for this election, of which there were a lot more, because a lot of people marked themselves as indefinitely confined during the COVID-19 pandemic because people weren't leaving their homes because of the virus.
Yeah, I mean, there are some groups of voters where we kind of don't know the universe of people that we're dealing with yet. But when it comes to people who said they were indefinitely confined, the state keeps records on that. And according to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, there were statewide nearly 216,000 voters said they were indefinitely confined in 2020. That was up from about 57,000 in 2016. How about in Dane and Milwaukee counties? If you add those together, you're talking about in this election, more than 68,000 voters said they were indefinitely confined, and that's up from 17,000 in 2016. So 68,000 voters that this recount is challenging. And I have no doubt that they're going to be able to find examples. I shouldn't say that I have no doubt. I would not be surprised if they were able to produce examples of people who were arguably not indefinitely confined. But they are talking about taking out nearly 70,000 votes, including people who, you know, who were indefinitely confined, I'm sure, with this challenge.
I think the thing that's really important to note here, too, before we move on, is that this indefinitely confined provision is actually kind of different from the other provisions that are challenged in the Trump recount request, in that language about indefinitely confined voters is written into state law, and guidelines for how indefinitely confined voters are defined is written into state law. The other things are Elections Commission policy procedure guidelines. They're not state laws. The things about, like, you know, we were talking about the absentee ballot application for in-person early voting and not having to fill out a paper application. That's a guideline. That's not in law. The language that's in law about indefinitely confined voters is essentially that a voter gets to decide, him or herself, whether they're indefinitely confined or not. And there isn't some sort of checklist to say, if you meet these criteria, you are indefinitely confined. The law says you decide if you're indefinitely confined or not. And I think that's a really important point.
So I guess we'll have to see sort of how those various questions play out. But the next thing I sort of want to get to is that the recount itself got underway today. We're recording this on Friday. And Laurel, you were in Madison at the site where they started recounting votes. Can you just sort of like paint a scene a little bit of what this looks like? Because this is actually the second recount that you've covered. But what was going on today?
Yeah, so this was so different than the 2016 recount that I covered. This year, the recount is happening at the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison. So big convention center. And it's this huge room, just like three or four ballrooms size of a room. Is there a standard ballroom size? I don't know. it's really big.
It's like roughly 1.5 ballroom size.
Right. I guess I should say like football fields or basketball courts, but I don't.
Is ballroom dancing an Olympic sport? Because if probably. So, then you would think there was a defined ballroom floor size.
Well, they would certainly not conduct it in this ballroom, which is exceedingly red. In my opinion.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Like the defining thing about the Dane County recount to me from watching it online all day is that it got a real ugly red floor.
Yeah, like, that's fair.
Shades of Twin Peaks a little bit.
Yeah, I guess that didn't strike me as much, but that's true in hindsight. It's an aggressively red floor.
You were there doing important work, talking to people and noticing things, but you missed the biggest takeaway, right. Which was their
red floor.
Bright red floor.
Yeah. So when you walk in and you tread on the red floor, you see there are just tons of long tables, like end to end, the long skinny tables. Card tables, that's the word I'm looking for, card tables. And they have plexiglass barriers built down the center. And on one side, you have an election worker that's processing ballots. And on the other side, there are usually three observers. And some people have brought like camp chairs and things to settle down on their observer side because they're going to be there for a bit. And essentially what happens is the election worker goes ballot by ballot. They hold it up so the observer can see it through the plexiglass. Then they put it down and they just kind of go one by one. And if the observer notes something that they want to object to, then the ballot goes into a separate pile with a little pink post-it note that says object, or an abbreviation for object. And it just kind of goes along that way. And that's how it's done today. It was all by hand. But starting tomorrow, Saturday, they're going to start using high-speed counting machines as well. So It was definitely an interesting scene. And like I said, very different from 2016. In 2016, it was in the Dane County Municipal Building at just two rooms, maybe three, but just a couple different rooms down, it's kind of scattered down a hallway. And this felt just much, much bigger and certainly a lot more observers. When I talked to the Monona Terrace folks, they said that there were at least a couple hundred observers in the building. And I absolutely think that that's true. It's hard with people coming and going. Anybody who wants to show up can be there. But like I said, there were three observers for basically every worker. And it was a very big room with a lot of workers.
And, you know, my impression, Laurel, from talking to you and I guess other sources too, is that like the atmosphere is a little more contentious this time than it was in the last recount that you covered in 2016. Because at 2016, there was Scott McDonald, the Dane County clerk, had this press conference yesterday where he was talking about 2016 a little bit. And that recount was ordered by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Democrats had already basically conceded the election. I mean, by this time in the election cycle, Tammy Baldwin, Wisconsin's Democratic U.S. Senator, was addressing President Trump as President-elect Donald Trump, something that you haven't heard from Republican Ron Johnson this time around. So obviously a different feel to this election. But that recount was challenged by a third party. And Scott McDonald said that you know, the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign were helpful in 2016, he said. This is a direct quote. Quote, I was sending the Trump campaign out to get more sandwiches and stuff, and they were great. I don't expect that to be the case this cycle. I mean, he was just kind of calling attention to the fact that like the atmosphere is different. But you tried to talk to some observers from that were there on behalf of President Trump this time. How did that go?
It didn't go great, Sean. So you can identify observers really easily because they all have little name tags on and they say whether they're there as a Trump observer or a Biden observer and they have their name. So it's really easy just to walk up to folks and say, hey, and I've obviously got all my badges on and everything and I've got my recorder and I'm like, hey, you know, can I ask you a couple questions? And I got several hell no's. And one woman started to speak with me. I was just asking, like, you know, there wasn't an election worker at the place where she and her friends were standing. So I said, oh, you know, what are you guys waiting for? And how long have you been waiting? And, you know, how do you guys decide who's going to go where? Do you all just kind of go to whatever spot you want? And she was answering my questions at first. And then her friends sort of like looked at her and were like, you're not supposed to talk to anybody. She just like stopped in the middle of a sentence and kind of gave me a side eye and I just backed away. I was like, I'm sorry. And I backed away. I had another moment where I was doing a very public radio thing and I probably will never use this tape, but I was actually recording the sound of someone just shuffling the papers, just taking one ballot and putting in a pile, ballot, pile, ballot, pile.
Always awkward.
So awkward because people are like, what is this woman doing?
Yep.
Exactly. And so I was doing it and the observers were clearly looking at me like I'm crazy and I don't blame them. And so as I turned off my recorder and as I was walking away, I kind of said, you know, oh, it's kind of funny to record the sound of just papers moving. And they just stared at me. the election
Thanks
worker
for making
sort
it
of
more awkward.
Yeah. The election worker sort of like gave me like a little like. You can't see her mouth, obviously, but yeah, she gave me like a little like shrug, head tilt, and I could sort of see with her eyes. She was like, you know, but the observers were just not having my attempt to make fun of myself at all. So it was, yes, very tense, safe to say. That's a good characterization.
So we've been going on about the recount here for a while, but before we move on to the other tons of news that are currently crushing in around us, can we maybe get into a little bit of wild speculation about where we think this recount will lead? Because, I mean, they'll count all the votes, but like we've said, the Trump side is raising a whole bunch of questions and issues. So what could happen next after the recount itself is done?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that this could end up in court. That's my bold, prediction. When you have, lawyers casting objections to what it, I guess, cumulatively could be north of a couple hundred thousand votes, if you include everything that they're challenging, that's probably like geared for a court challenge, because they're not like going ballot by ballot on this stuff. They're saying that the system was wrong and these ballots in these Democratic counties must be tossed. So that would probably end up before our state Supreme Court, which has a 4-3 conservative majority. And I can absolutely imagine, in fact, at this point, I'd be surprised if the eyes of the nation were not watching Wisconsin's Supreme Court to find out what they're going to do with some sort of a challenge to our election. I mean, I'm mentally there. Like, this is going to happen, and I'll be surprised if it doesn't happen. And it could be that, like, I'm literally just like thinking out loud here, but like, it could be that the state Supreme Court says, no, we're not going to hear that case, and that's the end of it. You know, they, because that's a decision in itself, right? Whether or not they hear a case is kind of a decision, and they could let the recount results stand. Or they hear it, and we have really like the most closely watched court case in the world for a while in our little Supreme Court. And everybody's talking about like, oh, who are these justices? And what's, Brian Hagedorn going to do? He's been a swing justice in other cases. Like, that could actually happen too. So that's my wild speculation there. But I don't think it's that wild given what's being challenged by lawyers for the Trump campaign.
Well, guys, it doesn't sound like anybody's up there trying to dig us out yet. So as long as we're still waiting, do we want to talk about coronavirus politics news?
Yeah, I mean, we say this all the time. It was just like another horrible, horrible week with COVID-19 news. And I mean, we've now had like our record-setting day of COVID-19 deaths. It was like 92 deaths in one day reported. According to the governor's office, at the majority of Wisconsin hospitals, nearly every ICU bed is full. Nearly one-third of ICU beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. And one-third of hospitals report staff shortages. So it is, pretty dire out there right now with regards to the pandemic. And here we go entering like regular flu season and the winter. So everything's great, I guess, is the way that I would sum all that up.
yeah.
Everything's super wonderful. So what?
That's not actually the news I was referencing. I was talking about the super interesting politics news related to the horrible COVID-19 news.
Yeah. A couple things happened this week. You had oral arguments in a case that one of the lawsuits that seeks to strike down the governor's emergency powers that he used to issue the statewide mask mandate. This is the case that was before the Wisconsin Supreme Court this week was brought by Jerry Fabik, a board member and policy advisor for the Heartland Institute, a big GOP donor. He's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Republicans over the years. He's given $20,000 to Justice Rebecca Bradley. He has argued that the governor's emergency powers under the law, he can't reissue a public health emergency for the same pandemic, which he has now done. He's issued 4 public health emergencies during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Mr. Fabik says, no, you can't do that without the legislature approving it. A governor's public health emergency powers last 60 days, and that's it. The governor says, no, the pandemic has changed. His latest emergency order is about how the hospital system is like at capacity right now. For example, it's a lot different than we were talking about when the pandemic began in March. And he also says the legislature can step in and revoke my orders at any moment. They need a majority vote and the order goes away and they haven't done that. So those, you know, we've talked about it quite a bit, those two arguments. And so this was the first chance we got to hear what might Supreme Court justices say about this? And specifically, what might Brian Hagedorn say about this? Because he sided with the court's liberals in the challenge to the Evers administration's Safer at Home order back in May. So Brian Hagedorn, I got to say, did not sound, I mean, he kind of telegraphed to me, to my ear, he sounded like somebody who was a bit more skeptical of the governor using these powers. I mean, on a couple occasions, he seemed to question how the governor could do this. You know, he said, like, nobody's questioning the governor's intentions here. But
let me talk about rainbows.
He did talk. I did tell you we would talk about that on the podcast, John. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. I didn't include it in my story, but Brian Hagedorn, you watched the arguments with me actually that day. Yeah. So, you know, you're going to help me with this example. Mm-hmm. Justice Hagedorn, who is a dad and like views the world through the dad lens. He said, in talking about the governor's emergency powers, help me out here, John.
He said that, all right, so like there's a rainbow in the backyard.
Yeah.
And he's lending his children his iPhone to take pictures of the rainbow. And he tells his young son, you can use my phone for 10 minutes to
It's 15, talk right? About it was 15?
I think it was 10, actually.
Okay.
His son can have the phone for 10 or 15 minutes to take pictures of the rainbow, whereas his daughter,
who's, I think, is 15
years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you're getting that idea. She will be given the phone to photograph the rainbow for as long as it is extant. And the younger child photographs the rainbow for 20 minutes and comes back and says, well, Dad, you know, the rainbow was still out there. So I know you said 10 minutes, but I needed to keep photographing it because it was still there. And Justice Hagedorn said, well, no, that was not our agreement. You only had 10 minutes. You're grounded, son. Whereas your sister has the ability to photograph the rainbow to her heart's content as long as it is present. All of this is to say,
this is why I did not put it in my story. I was like, I don't know. Even as a fellow dad, my answer is just like, no, you can't have my phone.
The rainbow is the coronavirus. His children, his son is the governor. His daughter is
local government.
Local governments, and they have different rules as to when they can issue orders and for how long to respond to this beautiful rainbow and or horrible pandemic that's killed thousands of people.
So I guess in sum, I would say, setting the rainbow example aside, which you can't do really, but I choose to, I would say that Justice Hagedorn said a couple other things on occasions there that just sounded to me like somebody who's wants people to brace for a ruling that's going to go a certain way. And I know we're often cautioned, don't listen to what justices say during oral arguments because they have to play devil's advocate. That's their job. But I don't know. I've listened to a lot of Supreme Court arguments where justices give very, you know, to me, they sound like clear hints and they end up being clear hints. So that's just what I heard in that case is that Brian Hagedorn is skeptical, at least, of the governor's assertion that he can issue multiple emergencies for the COVID-19 pandemic.
Which, bringing us up to speed to today, the governor did just that. I mean, this lawsuit that we heard arguments about was challenging one of his past emergency orders, but the governor telegraphed earlier this week, hey, I'm going to issue another order, extend the mask mandate, and then that actually finally came down Friday afternoon, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that was the order where this is his fourth one where he talked about hospital capacity being stretched, and he extended the mask mandate into January. Of course, if the Supreme Court steps in and rules you can't do that, then the, you know, the mask mandate goes away. Similarly, the legislature is going to be back in session soon, the new legislature, and they could vote on this stuff at some point, but they haven't so far.
Which sort of tees us up to talk about the other chunk of COVID-19 politics news that happened this week, which is that both the governor and GOP leaders, to a lesser extent, both sort of came out with ideas about new policy to combat COVID-19. And they're actually talking, which is not something they've done for months and months and months. So do you want to walk us through what happened on that front this week?
So what happened here, I think this was this Tuesday that Republicans had their press conference?
We have COVID time, like all of you out there. It's just pretty bad this week.
Someday this week that was not today, and it wasn't earlier. Yesterday.
Yeah, it was before. It was part of the avalanche of news.
Yeah. The Assembly Speaker Robin Voss put out a notice that he and Assembly Republicans were going to have a press conference about COVID-19 legislation in Wisconsin, which was a really big deal and pretty unexpected because we weren't expecting it. You know, the speaker has said in recent weeks that he would be open to another package of legislation about COVID-19. But as far as we knew, you know, he was kind of looking, and leaders in the Senate were looking to meet with the governor. Speaker Voss in particular made a statement after the governor gave his statewide address on COVID recently that he wanted to sit down and have this be kind of a bipartisan cooperative thing about COVID. And he thought that that's what people wanted. So the speaker putting out a statement saying, hey, Republicans are going to announce some proposals. We were all kind of taken aback because the message had been, we're all going to kind of do this holding hands, I guess. So immediately after, not immediately, but pretty quickly after Speaker Voss put out his statement that Republicans were going to have a press conference, the governor released his proposals related to COVID-19.
Right. It was like
15 minutes.
Voss, mm-hmm. Voss said, hey, we're going to have a press conference at 2 p.m. And then, you know, at like 12:15 or something, the Evers administration says, hey, here's this bill of our COVID plans.
Right. And they said when they released it that they had sent the proposals to Republican leaders, asked to have a meeting, and they hadn't heard back from Republicans yet. So that sort of handholding that we were potentially expecting pretty much crashed and burned at that point. We knew that Republicans and the governor were not really on the same page at that point, you know, kind of publicly releasing disparate things, the governor saying that they hadn't met with him about what he wanted to do, Republicans saying they were going to put forward what they wanted to do. And then that kind of teed up. That's where we were when the Republican press conference started. And I don't know, I feel like I've been talking for a while. So Sean, do you want to talk about what they said at the press conference?
Well, real quick, can I direct this a little bit?
Yeah.
So before we talk about what Republicans said in the afternoon, what were Evers' proposals that he came out with? What were some of the items specifically?
So there's a lot in the bill. I think AP said there was like 19 proposals in this one bill. You know, a lot of them had to do with health insurance coverage of COVID-19 treatment or medication. There was also another extension of waiving the waiting period for unemployment insurance. You know, Republicans added this 1 week waiting period to receive unemployment insurance. They agreed with the governor earlier this year to waive that. This would extend that waiver. But then there was other stuff in there that is kind of big. You know, there's a provision that would let the state issue a moratorium on evictions. There's a provision in there that would have the state pick up for the federal government when it comes to paying for testing, for COVID-19 testing, you know, because it's federal funding. In theory, the federal government and the president or president-elect could send down a bunch more federal money to states like Wisconsin to pay for testing and other expenses related to the pandemic. But if they don't, the governor's office is saying, we got to pay for it. And so they set aside $541 million in GPR, general purpose revenue, state money, to pay for that stuff. And so, you know, jumping ahead to like the speaker's reaction to those things, he's definitely not for the ban on evictions, and he's not for spending that much state money on, you know, testing, et cetera. So there's some pretty big differences between the governor and the speaker on the biggest items, you know, arguably in the governor's proposal.
So the governor's proposal comes out. He sort of scoops Republican leaders in terms of releasing these plans, including some of these big ticket items. And then what did Republican leaders have to say during their announced press conference about what they wanted to do as far as COVID goes?
So to be clear, this press conference was just Assembly Republicans. Senate Republicans didn't have anything to do with it. Which is an important point that we can get to later. But the Assembly press conference didn't lay out any really, they certainly didn't have language for bills. They didn't have that level of specificity yet. There were a couple things that they mentioned. The speaker said that he believes there needs to be more testing and more rapid testing in Wisconsin. He said that he wants to do some things related to business liability. He says he's heard that businesses are worried about getting sued right now, and he wants to have some protections for them put in place. He also talked about getting people who have lost their jobs in Wisconsin, people who are unemployed, working as contact tracers, kind of beefing up the state contact tracing system. So there were some specific proposals, but it wasn't at the level of what we got from the governor in terms of like, these are what the bills would be. This is kind of what the language would be.
Right. Voss and company essentially described it more as like, these are some ideas we have, even though they were supposedly going to release proposals.
So to just really get down into like the details of this, when the speaker put out his press conference, it said that they would hold a press conference about new legislative initiatives to help slow the spread of COVID-19. And I saw that and I thought, legislation, you know, bills. That is not what they had. You know, the speaker was very clear from the beginning of his press conference, we don't have bills. And I mean, I think that's really noteworthy because on the one hand, the governor is the governor and he should take the lead in negotiations like this. But in the lawsuit that Republicans filed in April that overturned Safer at Home, they told the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a legal brief that they were drafting legislation at the time to respond to the pandemic. That was in April. So they're talking with the governor. They're sharing ideas with the governor. But, you know, 8 months later, they are not going to be coming to the table with legislation.
And so I guess sort of where we leave it, I think I mentioned, is that, you know, they're talking now. They had a meeting today, Friday. The governor has legislation that he has put forward. Assembly Republicans don't, but they have these ideas. And so that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, I think that's where we are. So the governor put out a statement that said the conversation was he met with Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu, who's the new majority leader taking over for Senator Fitzgerald. The governor said the conversation was, quote, productive. Speaker Voss and Majority Leader Lemahieu, that's going to take me a little while to get used to.
We can't just say fit
anymore.
Yeah, right? Like it's nothing personal against the new majority leader. It's just we've been seeing Fitz for about 10 years now, and it's muscle memory at this point.
Exactly. Majority Leader LeMahieu and Speaker Voss put out a statement saying that they thought it was a, quote, productive conversation. They said there were some issues we agreed on and some that we didn't. Regardless, they see it as a positive step forward. So seems like maybe we're in a place where there's some agreement happening, maybe?
I don't know. All they're saying is that they talked and, like, they're willing to keep talking. But they're just so far apart on... like mitigation issues. Like, the legislature is not going to agree to a mask mandate for, let's say, the Supreme Court strikes down the governor's emergency orders. Can you imagine the legislature saying, we'll step in and we'll pass that for you, governor? It was just a separation of powers issue for us. Now that we've got that cleared away, like, we'll pass this. I don't know that I could imagine that happening, you know? I think they're pretty far apart when it comes to, like, closing businesses to prevent the spread of COVID or mandating masks to prevent the spread of COVID, which are kind of the big steps that the Evers administration has taken. So I don't know what they're going to agree on. I mean, I know the hospital association stepped in and said, we have to do something about this. Governor and legislative leaders, the hospital situation is horrible. So maybe that's an area where they can come together and agree on something.
And I'll say something obvious, which is not only are the governor and Republican lawmakers pretty far apart on how they want to approach things, the Senate and the Assembly are also very different bodies with different Republican caucuses that haven't in the past agreed about things. And so even if the Assembly can agree to some COVID policies that maybe the governor agrees with, their path in the Senate might be pretty rocky. We know that Senate President Chris Kapinga, newly elected Senate president, said earlier this week that he didn't see any COVID proposals after the governor released his and Speaker Voss released his that were exciting to him, that he was particularly interested in. So it's not going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, and we have not covered this new Senate yet, you know? The Senate is more conservative than it was before the election. The Republicans flipped two seats in the Senate. We said all the time, it was shorthand in our stories, Republicans have big majorities in the Assembly and the Senate. It got bigger in the Senate. They added two seats in the Senate, and we don't really know what, like, Senator LeMahieu is going to be like as a leader. We know Senator Kapinga is very outspoken and very conservative, and he's been doing a lot of the talking right now for Senate Republicans in the early stages of that kind of new regime. So, yeah, even if Speaker Voss and the governor agree to something, which sounds like an impossibility almost in, like, our world of state government, like you said, Laurel, it's no guarantee that the Senate's going to want anything to do with it.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, and we'll be here to cover it, assuming we ever make it out of this tiny air pocket surrounded by news, you know, pressing in from all sides.
Play the record, John.
Anybody,
calm down.
Any digging,
calm down and
don't worry.
Put on some,
I mean, I got all of the records here. I got, you know, Mr. Wonderful. I got Future Games. I got Bear Trees, Penguin, Mystery to Me, Tusk, Mirage, Rumors, of course, Tango in the Night. We're good for a while. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
And John K. Wilson is our resident politics nerd and Fleetwood Mac aficionado.
We'll get you out of this, buddy. You just keep the hope, okay? Next week, we're going to be talking about this from outside of an avalanche.
Well, I've been afraid.
First off, a big thank you to WPR's Rich Kramer for his vocal cameo at the beginning of today's show. A true friend of the podcast, that guy. And if you would like to be a friend of the podcast as well, the first thing to do would be to subscribe, and you'll get new episodes delivered to you almost every single week. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast apps. And while you're there, leave a rating or a review of the show to help other people find it. And of course, you can catch up on all of our past episodes anytime at wpr.org/politicspodcast.
And if you see my reflection in the snow-covered hills, well, a landslide brings